I think we have to look to this earlier period then to get some understanding of our ultimate failure in Vietnam. During the period 1950 to 1965, of course, our policy goes through three quite distinct phases. 1950 to 54, support for the French, to the point by 1954 that we're paying roughly 80% of the cost of the French war effort in Indochina. 1954 to 59, we helped to ease the French out of Vietnam. We played a key role as midwife at the birth of South Vietnam, and ignoring the letter and spirit of Geneva, tried to sustain an independent government below the 17th parallel. 1959 to 65, a third phase through increased economic and military aid, eventually thousands of military advisors, we tried to help the South Vietnamese government put down an insurgency which had begun in the South in the late 50s, in which by 1965 enjoyed large-scale support from North Vietnam. Each step along the way, of course, policy failed to produce the desired results, leading to the next step of escalation. In July 1965, of course, the ultimate step was required. Why was this so? Again, obviously no easy answers, highly controversial issues which historians, if not policymakers and others, will be arguing about for years to come. In terms of the French War, the so-called First Indochina War, in a broad general sense, I think the answer seems reasonably clear. France's goal, the retention of some level of imperial control in Indochina, ran against one of the major currents of post-World War II history. Throughout Asia and Africa, in time, the nationalist revolutions prevailed. And even when the imperial nations were able to win wars, as France later in Algeria, they were forced ultimately to abandon what they had gained at such cost. They were forced to concede independence. From the time we began supporting France in 1950, I think we understood this problem all too well, but we couldn't find any way to resolve it. We pressed the French to fight on until victory had been won. At the same time, we pressed them to promise to leave as soon as victory had been won. It made no sense from their point of view. And when faced with the choice of fighting for Vietnamese independence or withdrawing, they chose ultimately the latter. Ironically, there is some evidence to suggest that the French may have come closer to winning a short-term victory than they themselves realized at the time. Some evidence to indicate that during the Dien Bien Phu crisis of 1954, while France was pressing the United States to intervene, Ho Chi Minh was pressing the Chinese and the Russians to intervene, warning that the Viet Minh had suffered such heavy losses that it could not continue the war much longer. This, of course, raises the tantalizing possibility that if Eisenhower and Dulles had listened to the French and intervened in 1954, a favorable settlement might have been attained without the bloodshed and agony that followed. Possibly, but I think doubtful. Had we gone in, it is difficult to see how the Russians and Chinese, particularly the Chinese, could have stayed out. Even if they had stayed out, could we, with or without the French, have constructed and sustained a viable government in fragmented, war-torn Vietnam? All of this, in any event, of course, is speculation. The great powers did not intervene. The Russians and Chinese imposed on the Viet Minh a settlement less favorable than they thought they were entitled to. The United States refused to bail out the French, not, as is often argued, primarily because the British refused to go in, but in the final analysis, because we couldn't agree with the French on what we would be fighting for and how we would fight once we got into the war. Even while the Geneva Conference was going on, of course, the United States was planning ways to exploit partition to create a bulwark against further communist expansion in Vietnam. The reasons for the failure of American efforts to sustain an independent non-communist South Vietnam from 1955 on, more complex and elusive still, I think. There are several factors which seem to stand out. First, perhaps foremost, often overlooked, although it's fundamental, was the magnitude and intractability of the problem itself. Had we looked all over the world, we might not have been able to choose a less promising place for an experiment in nation building. the economy shattered from 10 years of war. The departure of the French left a gaping political vacuum in South Vietnam. The French, having destroyed the traditional fabric of Vietnamese politics, imposed direct imperial control in the South. When they pull out, there's nothing to replace them. They left behind no firmly established political institutions, no native elite capable of exercising effective leadership. In addition, southern Vietnam was fragmented by a multitude of conflicting political, religious, and ethnic groups. In the words of one scholar, a political jungle of warlords, bandits, partisan troops, secret societies. Add to that the immigration of nearly 1 million Catholics from the North after 1954, an event which, whatever its humanitarian aspects, adds to the already confused and conflict-ridden picture in the South, and of course removes from North Vietnam, conveniently, a major source of dissidents. Under these circumstances, there may have been built-in limits to what the United States or any outside nation might have accomplished in Vietnam. Secondly, I think it is clear, again in retrospect, that in cases our nation-building policies were misdirected or misapplied. In the early years, to give just one example, we focused on building an army to meet the threat of invasion from the North. Perfectly logical step in terms of the situation in Vietnam and the experience of Korea, but one which left the South Vietnamese ill-prepared to cope with the insurgency that erupted in the late 1950s. Another problem, perhaps the critical problem, the question of native leadership, a problem all too clearly revealed in our frustrating and ultimately tragic partnership with Zhou Zinh-Zien. In terms of his anti-communism, his nationalism, Zim appeared to fit our needs perfectly. And in his first years, he seemed a miracle worker, stabilizing South Vietnam in a way no one thought possible. In time, however, the deficiencies became apparent. It was not simply, or perhaps even primarily, that his government was corrupt and undemocratic. Corrupt governments have survived for years, after all. And Zim may have had logic on his side when he warned that democracy would not work in Vietnam. There were other problems, in many cases more basic. A poor administrator, tolerated far too much from his notorious family. More important, perhaps, he lacked any real blueprint for a modern Vietnam. He tended to look backward to Imperial Vietnam for his model, not seeing the ways in which French imperialism, the Viet Minh Revolution, indeed, had destroyed the old order. He is in many ways the tragic figure in a war in which there are hundreds of thousands of tragic figures, a man who, for the most part, lived in a world of his own, a world that existed only in the past, if it existed at all. He proved incapable in the final analysis of mobilizing the peasantry, coping with the insurgency, of providing the leadership skills needed in a terribly, terribly complex and difficult situation. He was also, of course, fiercely independent, and this posed a dilemma the United States could never really resolve. Americans came in time to see his deficiencies, but they could not persuade him to change his ways, nor could they impose their will on him. They saw no alternative to him, and feared that if they removed him, it would only lead to greater chaos. Thus, with some reluctance, we stood behind him for 9 years, while the political and military situation steadily deteriorated. Ziem is Ziem, but the best we've got, Kennedy commented. Sink or swim, with Zhou Dinh Ziem, a cynical journalist, summed up American policy. It was only when Ziem's policies produced the full-scale political upheaval of 1963, the Buddhist crisis, and perhaps, too, when it was learned that he and his brother were secretly negotiating with Hanoi, that the United States finally concluded he must go. As many had predicted, however, the coup of November 63 offered no solutions, only more problems, something I think that was quite well dramatized in the film last night. The generals who replaced Diem, for the most part educated in France or the United States, they too lacked touch with their own people, and even less than Diem had the ability to unify a fragmented society. Divided among themselves, they spent their energy on intrigue, and one coup followed another in such rapid fashion that it was impossible to keep up with the changes from day to day. Thus, by 1965, we found ourselves in a position we had never really wanted, I think, and whose dangers were all too clear, that of an outside power moving to fill a political and military vacuum, a thankless, maybe impossible role. To stop here, of course, focusing on our failure is to provide only a one-sided picture. We need at least to note why the other side by 1965 had reached the verge of victory. We now know, again ironically from captured documents, that by 1957, Diem had very nearly exterminated those Viet Minh who had stayed behind after Geneva. Alarmed by their plight, by the certainty that the elections called for by Geneva would not be held, the remaining stay-behinds begin to mobilize to try to salvage the revolution of 1945. They effectively exploit the unrest caused by Diem's heavy-handed methods. In this sense, again ironically, his near success is the source of his ultimate failure. In many areas, they implemented land reform programs that contrasted favorably with the policies of the government. But lest they be portrayed, as they were in the anti-war rhetoric of the time, as Robin Hoods stealing from the rich to help the poor, let it also be noted that they used selective violence with great effectiveness to solidify their control. Whatever the method, they mobilized the peasantry in many areas in a way the government had not been able to up to this point, to the point that by 1963 they controlled large segments of the land and population, had developed a formidable army. They were able increasingly to identify with Vietnamese nationalism, to cast the United States in the role of successor to France. North Vietnam's part in all of this remains, of course, a matter of controversy. It does seem clear that Hanoi did not instigate the revolution in the South, as the United States government claimed at the time. Nor did it remain an innocent and even indifferent bystander, as the Doves frequently argued. The revolution appears to have begun spontaneously in the South, initially at least against the wishes, maybe even against the instructions of the Hanoi government. Once it began, however, North Vietnam could not stand back. It had to fear that if the revolutionaries failed, that could be the end of its hopes of unifying Vietnam forever and all time. If they succeeded without North Vietnamese help, then you've got another situation. You've got a successful revolution over which Hanoi exercises no control. It is at this point, then, that North Vietnam begins to send cadres south to assume leadership positions in the insurgency to begin to take control as much as that is possible. In 1959, Hanoi approved the initiation of armed struggle against the Diem government. In the aftermath of the overthrow of Diem, North Vietnam decides to undertake a major escalation of the conflict, even to the point of sending its own units south to fight intact. It took this step apparently, and I emphasize the apparently because obviously there's much we don't know about motivation on that side, apparently in the expectation that the United States, when faced with certain defeat, would be reasonable and would withdraw, as it had in China in 1949, rather than risk its own men and own resources to save South Vietnam. In this, of course, the North Vietnamese gravely miscalculated, if this was their point of view. Confronting the collapse of South Vietnam in 1965, Lyndon Johnson never seriously considered the option of withdrawal. He was determined to uphold a commitment of more than a decade. He was certain that tiny Vietnam could not defy the will of the world's greatest power. He first initiates the bombing of North Vietnam, and then in July 1965, as we saw portrayed last night, commits American ground forces to the struggle. In making this latter commitment, however, he also seems to have seriously miscalculated. He rejected Secretary McNamara and the Joint Chiefs' proposals to mobilize the reserves, to avoid any risk of confrontation with Russia and China. More important, perhaps, from his personal standpoint, to prevent what he once called that bitch of a war from interfering with what he termed the woman I really love, the great society, he escalated the war quietly while trying to impose the lightest possible burden on the American people. And he did all this with the expectation, or maybe even calculated gamble that the gradual increase of military pressure on North Vietnam would bring it to its senses, persuade it to abandon the struggle in South Vietnam. Why then did we go to war in Vietnam? We went to war as a result of a series of incremental commitments made over a period of 15 years, each of which stemmed in one way or another from the larger dictates of the containment policy. A policy which viewed most conflicts, local conflicts, as deriving from the Cold War, which tended at least to a point to define all areas of the world as of equal importance. At each stage of the game, there was a recognition of the pitfalls of escalation, but given the requirements of containment, policymakers saw no option but to act as they did. And I think at each critical juncture, they were hopeful, maybe even confident, that a larger injection of American influence and power would turn the tide. The essential flaw of American policy was not, I think, as many now argue, that we misused our military power, but rather that we intervened in a situation where local forces ran against us. We supported eventually a weak, fragmented client state against a determined, indeed fanatical adversary in a situation where all-out war was either too risky or likely to be counterproductive. It may have been the classic no-win situation. The surprising thing, when viewed from a more distant perspective somewhere down the road, may be that we persisted as long as we did in the face of this kind of frustration. At this point, I'll leave it to my distinguished successor to carry the story on and to agree or disagree, whatever. Thank you very much.
My name is Gary Gordon. I'm a Vietnam veteran, a counselor with the Vet Center
program. Gary Gordon, a counselor with the Vet Center program, San Antonio, and Vietnam veteran.
A little louder, Gary. Get the volume up.
Okay, my name is Gary Gordon. I'm a counselor with the Vet Center program in San Antonio, Texas. He's a Vietnam veteran. One of the questions, kind of through bunker talk in Vietnam, not having the historical perspective to work with and seeing why the United States was involved, but being there and involved, the question quite often came about of the economics of war, you know, talking in terms of the billions of dollars, you know, that were going in. I was wondering from a historical perspective.
Yeah, let me take it okay. From there. There's several ways you can look at that. Are you referring more to the fact that, say, by 1968 or 69, we had invested in the war itself X number of dollars, the investment trap notion that the more you put in, you have to go, it puts more pressure on you to get something out of it? Or are you thinking more in terms of what would be the idea that certain American companies, through the years of our involvement, had established certain interests that then had to be defended? I mean, there are at least two separate areas here. I'm not persuaded by the second. The first, yes, obviously, is a problem. It may not be as much a problem of money as I suggested earlier, a problem in terms of prestige, or both. Maybe you can't separate the two. And certainly, the longer you get involved, the deeper the commitment, the more difficult it is to extricate yourself in any way. Indeed, I think I'm more sympathetic to the dilemma Johnson faced in 65, because by that time we had, you know, it's a commitment of at least 10 years in clear form, with large numbers of Americans there, and Americans as graphically displayed last night dying. So it's a much more complex problem than, say, Eisenhower would have faced 10 years earlier. Maybe the last best time to extricate ourselves would have been at the time of the Buddhist upheaval, when Diem is, or it could have in effect been saying to us, why don't you leave, or we could have at least used that to leave. After that, I'm not so sure, because some of the reasons you're suggesting. On the other hand, I'm not so clear. The business thing cuts both ways. Yeah, there were some businesses, and I gather some Houston businesses, which did profit in some ways out of war construction and the like. On the other hand, at the time of Tet, where some of the most important pressures for leveling off or extrication coming from. When Clark Clifford is beginning to press Lyndon Johnson to de-escalate, he is citing, and presumably reliably, pressures from a lot of key elements of the economy saying, this thing is draining us, it is destroying the economy, we've got to find some way to pull out. So I would look at it that way. I've heard even lots of stories along the lines you suggest, and indeed some say, well, the key is the Mitchell and rubber plantation or something like that. You know, I don't think it's quite that simple. In the sense that in the earlier years, in the sense that Vietnam is considered a key to protecting the resources of Indonesia, yeah, this is important. But this is at a time when we have virtually nothing, and the French did not maintain anything like an open-door policy. And so we had virtually no investments or economic influence or interest in Vietnam before 1955. There is some concern in the 50s about Japan. You know, if Southeast Asia goes communist, what is Japan going to do in terms of raw materials and markets? All very ironic, because we had moved towards war in 1941 to prevent Japan from dominating Southeast Asia in terms of markets and raw materials. That's a concern, too, at least through the mid-50s, probably beyond the mid-50s.
Jack Jones from Salado.
Can't hear it, Larry.
And I'm with Public Radio out here, KNCT, and with the Clean Herald. Professor, why did not Lyndon Johnson call out the reserves like Truman did in Korea? To me, that's the very...
Well, my understanding is that what I suggested, that it's partly a problem of trying, we talked about this last night, partly a matter of trying to escalate the war quietly and get the job done with as small a disruption to the everyday life of the country and to the great society as possible. There are indications that he remembered rather well the uproar when Kennedy mobilized the reserves over the Berlin crisis in 1961, and that this is something that caused a lot of stir in the country and a lot of people, Johnson in particular, remembered this and said, hey, I don't want this kind of thing happening. Keep in mind June, July 1965, when all this is being done. And some of the key Great Society legislation is moving through Congress right at that precise time. And so they're very much concerned not to get this disrupted. But it is a problem, and a serious problem. Whether it would have made a difference, either in terms of making it easier to fight the war, some have argued that if we had taken those steps, mobilized the reserves, even gotten another specific congressional resolution, that the people would have been committed to a point then where they could not have backtracked when the going got tough, say, in 68, 69. I'm not altogether convinced by this. You look at the Korea, one of the more revealing sort of statistics, I think, is that the public opinion, public approval patterns and the like for Vietnam and Korea are almost identical in terms of that initial rally around the flag surge that we talked about last night, and then a steady decline as the cost increases in terms of lives and dollars. The patterns are very close, almost identical, even though we don't usually think. We think of Korea as maybe not a popular war, but not one that aroused the sort of dissent that Vietnam did. So I'm not even sure that a resolution, I mean, the Tonkin Gulf resolution was passed in 64, and by 67, it's eventually dropped later on. I'm not sure that mobilizing the reserves and doing all these things would have given us a stake in the war that would have protected the domestic flank against dissent. I'm not convinced that's the case, but that is, of course, an argument that's made. I don't know. Maybe Doug can, we'll talk about this.
Closer. I'm Paul Woodruff. I'm a Vietnam veteran and now a teacher and a writer. I was in Chau Dac province in the Delta in 1969, and my impression of the attitude of many of the Vietnamese there, who were natives of that area, was that they didn't like either side very much. Our side was led by North Vietnamese Catholics who were trying to impose a Western-style centralized state. Their side was led by North Vietnamese communists who were trying to establish a Western-style centralized state. And there was nobody in the picture who came at all close to representing them except the old warlords, who still, to some extent, surprisingly survived. My question is this. Do you think it would have been possible in 1954, in the years following, for us to encourage the development of a regime which would have belonged more to the people of South Vietnam than either of the possibilities that survived in the 60s?
It's a very, very good question, and you can only speculate, obviously, on the answers. Can we do it? That something like this might have taken form at some time? Yes, maybe. Can we do it as an outside nation who had been identified with the French, who knew virtually nothing about the people of Vietnam, the culture of Vietnam? We had to send abroad to find experts in those early years to try to... The people who could speak the language or read the language, or you could probably have listed on the fingers of one hand. Something like that might have taken form at some time. What would have happened in 1954, 55, 56, for example, if we had not moved in and assisted in the sort of establishment and consolidation of the Diem government? Is a fascinating question to ponder. I don't think the North Vietnamese at that time could have imposed their will on what is still a recalcitrant South. It's plain from what little we get out of there that although they've taken all the classic steps to solidify control, they still haven't done it in the way they would like. The black market still functions in Saigon, not at a level it did in the mid-60s, but still functions. The moving people out of the cities and resettlement programs have not been terribly effective. There is a lot of dissidence expressed in the form of passive resistance. And I don't know, the problem in southern Vietnam, that's why it's so complicated. There's a situation you describe. There are the sects, the Cao Dai, the Ho Hao, which Diem had managed to sort of put under control for a while, but which throughout the First War, the Second War, maintained a degree of autonomy. It's a very, very complicated situation, and I think something like that could have, maybe even in 1963, when there's that very complicated set of negotiations, which we know very little about, when the Diem government is actually talking or has agents talking with Hanoi about some kind of a deal whereby if the United States pulls out, some sort of a neutralist government emerges in the South. Now, what's that? How's that going to be put together? What's it be composed of? That's a very tough question. Would have been the ultimate question for them. Okay, but yeah, I that would have been probably the best. But it's very complicated. Somebody's got to be in control some way. And how do you bring this very diverse situation together? One more, is that?
All right. Try to make it brief.
Yeah, okay.
I'm Alan Pusey with the Dallas Morning News, and yesterday evening, Dr. Rostow, in encountering some of the elements in the film we saw, suggested that Hanoi had not only some designs on the South, but in fact had a more imperial vision of taking over the rest of the French Indochina Empire. Do you agree with that point of view?
I think it from time to time it may vary somewhat in intensity and commitment. You have to concede that the party as it was originally drawn up was the Indochinese Communist Party, right? Not the Vietnamese Communist Party. That goes back to the 30s. You have to take into account the fact that the centuries of conflict between Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians, and the fact that I think Hanoi would be determined to get some kind of a settlement out of that that they did not regard as threatening. China is the key. You see. China, I think, is the key. Harry said to be brief, and that opens up all kinds of new complexities. Yes, there is that element in it. Now, whether it predominates at every stage, I think it depends on other factors as to how committed they are to following through on it. What kind of government you have in Phnom Penh, Vientiane, what role are the Chinese playing? I'll stop there.
That concludes this session. Thank you.